Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The number of cattle on feed on June 1st was just over 11.8 million head, which was about 1% above a year ago, and the highest June 1st inventory number since the series began in 1996.
USDA out with their latest cattle on feed report. Shel Shagan, USDA livestock analyst.
During May, just under 1.9 million head of cattle were placed on feed, which was about 2% below a year ago. During May, feedlots marketed just over 1.9 million head, which was about 2% above a year ago. However, there was one additional slaughter day in May this year compared to last year. And when you make that adjustment, you are talking about a marketing number, which is about 2.5% below a year ago.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
House Democrat folks put forward a bill. They've actually put a number of bills together, and they titled it Lower Food and Fuel Costs, which House Resolution 7606. And I have to say, I describe it as a cute, although terribly dishonest, new title.
Representative G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania is the ranking member of the House Ag Committee.
It did have with it a few bills that were strongly bipartisan that I'm very proud of, but it also had a poison pill in there. And in short, the crisis that farmers are facing with input costs and consumers are facing with food and fuel costs, that cannot be mitigated with unfunded mandates and duplicative authorities, politicized agencies, and quite frankly, big government. So, the poison pill within there was meat and poultry special investigator bill, which is quite frankly is just not necessary. Would probably drive up the cost of food in the long run, may result in greater concentration of that protein processing industry. And we already have a division within USDA that does a great job. The Stockyards and Packers Division closed out 1,900 bills just in the year 2020, or investigations in the year 2020. And that doesn't speak to all the investigations they were actually responsible for. This particular bill was sort of it's one of President Biden's it's not my fault type pieces of legislation, trying to blame higher food costs on someone else. In this case, it really was on the poultry and meat processors. I'm afraid this bill, because of the new compliance, the uncertainty of who do you listen to, who's in charge? Is it this position that would be created? Is it the USDA investigators and attorneys that they have already working on this? Is there going to be an increase in compliance costs? And in the end, when there's an increase in government, the cost to comply with government regulations, it's the consumer that pays the bill.
But says it's not that there's not an issue there, it's how to find a solution.
We put a competing bill out there that we introduced last week, which was H.R. 8069, and that's entitled the Reducing Farm Input Costs and Barriers to Domestic Production Act. And this one really was, focused on achieving in real time. It essentially would codify what we had outlined in the letter to President Biden asking him to voluntarily take action. We don't see that happening. So we did put all that in the form of a piece of legislation. Had 20 co-sponsors originally. Just a great piece of legislation if we could get this completed, because it would require EPA to restore science in their decisions. It would provide clarity with WOTUS. It would rescind that SEC harmful proposed rule. And it would reinstate the 2020 NEPA streamlining and require an economic analysis on the costs and benefits of GIPSA rules. So it would truly deliver in near time, reducing farm input costs. That and a whole lot more. That actually would deal with the mining, refining of what we need in order to produce domestic fertilizer here. Really touches on the issues that our American farmers are struggling with.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I think it's important to understand the context of those different prices.
Ben O'Brien is a Kansas State grain economist.
Come back and look at corn first. Well, this fall that it happened down to 746 and three quarters basically still keeps us pretty much in the middle of the price trading range that we've been in since the last part of February, ranging from $7 to $8.25. 746, pretty much in the middle of that. Last couple, 2-3 days, down some, but still not a major change in where we're at. More concerned, though, when you look at the wheat market, and again, we're in the midst of harvest of the hard red winter wheat crop, and seasonal lows are not uncommon. Even if the crop is not that good, still you've got wheat coming that'll be sold. And we can come back and talk about that in terms of how farmers may respond to this. But you look at 10.05, and that's coming down just touching on basically a $10 low that happened back around the 1st of April, just a few days ahead of that. So we are coming down towards historic lows, recent lows, excuse me, for the July 2022 contract, and that has concern for people that watch closely the technical side of the futures contracts. Whereas corn, pretty much in the middle, we are down towards the lower end of the recent trading range for wheat, so that's of concern. For soybeans, somewhere in the middle. Basically, we had been trading in a range of about 15.60 up to just under $18, closed yesterday at 15.93 and a quarter. So, you know, we're only 40-some cents above the lower end of the trading range, which extends all the way back to into February. So different reasons for that. I think there are some supply-demand factors at play, and that would be the absence of China from buying grains here of late, particularly for soybeans. That's a big deal. But a lot of what happened yesterday, if we look at the overall factors, again, not a lot of grain supply-demand changes. In fact, some very bullish things happening out in the world, but rather as the financial markets are receiving signals from respected prognosticators that the likelihood of a recession in the U.S. is, you know, it's a 50-50 deal.
So why do sellers sell?
In the notes that we hand out each week, I do have on there a chart of the Dow Jones Industrial Index as well as on the oil market. And here we're trading at about 30,677, and we were at a high not that long ago in January, about 37 some. So you're down 20 some percent, you know, and just a lot of concerns emerging about where the markets will go. So with these drops, then people in agriculture are on the one hand, they're saying, well, our supply demand picture hasn't changed that much. But yet, in terms of what people that are pricing our commodities are doing, they're dropping the price based on broader financial concerns. So the conundrum is, do we, when we do get, say, wheat now in hand and fall crops coming on, does that motivate people to wait for something better to come because they think the fundamentals probably be supportive? Or is this big systematic, does that compel them to more, quote, pull the trigger on cash sales? I guess I just need to take a look at, since the wheat harvest is right upon us, look at cash prices for wheat. As of yesterday, June 23rd, in Salina, really kind of a bellwether market in the state, highest cash price at the major terminals was $9.90. If you look at a week ago, that number was about $11.28, as I recall. So we've dropped about $1.38.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Chairman, you've got your hands full right now. This is the Wall Street Journal from Tuesday. We had economists say recession is likely. Down here we said stocks are not bottoming very soon. So we've got some concerns. I know yesterday you were in the Senate, and there was a lengthy discussion on inflation, which there has been here as this morning as well.
Representative Blaine Lutkemeyer from Missouri is a member of the House Financial Services Committee and speaking with Fed Chairman Jerome Powell.
In my mind, there's four root causes of inflation. Now, we've had economists in your chair a few weeks ago, and I had one in my Small Business Committee a couple weeks before that, and I asked the same question to them. I said, it looks to me like there's four causes of inflation: monetary supply, rules and regulations, energy, and supply chain slash job problems that we have with workers in the economy today. And they both agreed that's basically your four problems that are underpinning inflation. I asked them to give me a percentage on each one of them. They said roughly 40% for money supply, 20. So I guess my concern is that, you know, if you look at those four causes, you're trying to help fight inflation. That's one of your mandates. And you really under money supply is the only thing you have any ability to do something with. And even then, it's probably only half of it because Congress has control over how many dollars are put into the system with additional bills, like the $1 trillion stimulus package from last year, taxes and things like that. So it looks like you have a minimal amount of impact out of those four things. So it looks to me quite oftentimes whenever you're trying to control the inflationary stuff with the interest rate, it's kind of over here trying to do a little something when over here there's all sorts of stuff going on. And the administration seems to be a contradiction to some of the things you're trying to accomplish over. Do you ever feel like that? Do you believe that may be a position that you're in right now?
So we're very focused on the part of the job that we can do and using our tools to do it.
Well, I understand that, Mr. Chairman, but I would seem they would think that all these other factors fall outside your purview here, and for you to try and manipulate it and everybody rely on you to solve the inflation problem by tinkering with the interest rate over here, it looks like that's a little overhyping the situation. But one of the things that is very concerning is the regulatory cost. In my discussion with the economist, he said, look, and this is the administration's own figures, last year, Biden administration, the cost of compliance with new regulations was $201 billion. That's astronomical. That's a huge cost that has to be built into all the small businesses and other businesses whenever they produce products and services for sale for customers. They've got to build in an additional $200 billion in costs every year. Would you agree that's a huge driver of inflation?
It sounds like a big number, yeah. And as you know, we try at the Fed to weigh costs and benefits and take that into consideration.
Would you agree that those other four things that I said are underpinning inflation, would you agree that those probably are the four major problems?
Yeah, so overwhelmingly most economists would not think of it in terms of money supply, but would think of it in terms of supply and demand. And although there may be a role for money supply, they would think in terms of supply and demand being out of balance. And that's how I think about it.
You know, the definition of inflation I've always had was too many dollars chasing too few goods and services. If you throw more money in, you have more money to supply it to the consumers.
There's 40 plus years of history and actually Milton Friedman at the end came back and said, you know, that's not really working anymore.
Mr. Chairman, I just
maybe working again though.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Yeah, there's irrigated out there now that, you know, looks quite good, you know, from that standpoint.
Dr. Darren Hudson is director of the International Center for Ag Competitiveness at Texas Tech.
But certainly we're nowhere near a production level we had hoped to be, given especially where prices were initially. And we're certainly, you know, if we get rain, it's going to help what's left, but certainly not going to save anything, any of the cotton crop that's already sort of burned up. So I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding at this point.
Hudson, looking specifically at cotton, but admits all markets are retreating right now.
I can't describe it any other way than the market sort of vomiting. You know, it's just everything has just been, you know, cascading downward in large part. I mean, we've seen some rebound in corn and wheat hasn't. Wheat's been on a longer downtrend. We haven't seen like the last few days the kind of action that we've seen in other markets.
So if the U.S. has lost a tenth of its production, usually those supply concerns elicit a demand rally.
That's a good question. You know, from a fundamental standpoint, we think of sort of supply side factors, which we just got through talking about, and demand side factors, the octane. If you look at the export reports, I mean, cotton is selling like hotcakes. I mean, China's bought a million, you know, tons of, there's, you know, a couple million tons going elsewhere, a million bales, sorry. And so the demand seems to not be cascading downward. The supply is, though, which would lead you to think, we should see at least support at the previous price levels, if not, some signals to go higher. So given the action that's happening across a lot of these markets, it makes me wonder if what we're seeing here are funds and institutional investors exiting positions in order to try to, take what profits they had in it in anticipation of, maybe potentially lower demand that might soften those markets. But, it's hard to tell, over a 3 or 4 day period, kind of what's happening in the institutional market.
So where's the movement coming from? Maybe managed money.
You'd be hard pressed to find sort of fundamental reasons why we should be at 98 cents in the December contract as opposed to, say, $1.15. The supply side certainly is not conducive to softening of that market. But I've quit trying to guess the sort of the short run fluctuations in the market because there's so many factors out there. I really don't have a clear answer. I just don't think, I think there's some buying opportunities here at 98 cents thinking that price is going to go back up before December as we start to realize the losses, the scale of the losses that we're having with this drought. But again, if you're hard-pressed to explain what a hedge fund in New York is actually thinking.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
High gasoline prices, inflation, the actions by the Fed, a whole number of things. So it brings back something you and I talked about last week, and that what happens in the financial markets tends to bleed over, it tends to have impacts on the commodity. And it seems most of what happened yesterday is a response of the agricultural futures to what was happening in the overall financial markets.
That's Kansas State grain economist Dr. Dan O'Brien. He also focuses on weather conditions.
We've had hot, dry weather for the most part for the last week or so. And by itself, without the financial markets, we'd be at least moving sideways until that worked itself out. There is a weather report that in about a week, within the next 6 to 10 days, that some moisture is expected in some key corn growing areas, corn and soybeans, basically. So that expectation is, something that's hoped for really. I think we're in a situation now where in the world we're hoping for good bushels everywhere because we're that tight for good yields. That in itself is just one more factor that's kind of holding down any rally in the corn market. And note, still, even on yesterday's market, soybeans were down 59 cents, corn down 21. So they're still concerned about all this and how it works out. So I think we're in a situation now, and we're in a weather market view of the world. If those rains don't come to the degree that we're hoping for, then you've got support coming thereafter. So the market will be watching those weather systems to see if they actually deliver on the hopes and promises of moisture, and the markets will respond accordingly.
And when we hit June 30th, a truckload of reports from USDA.
There's a USDA acreage report that'll come out. There's also a stocks report that'll show what usage in recent quarters have been. We watch that mainly for feed usage. That acreage report on the 30th has the potential to bring volatility to the market in either way. And been some expectation that perhaps corn acres will be a little bit higher than the prospective plantings report at the end of March had shown. So if that happens, that's a little bit bearish. If it should go the other way, in some people's minds, heaven forbid, then you're cutting down the likelihood of a strong U.S. crop all that much more. So that'll be a big day and big information that could bring volatility to the market. And as you look at cash prices, we'd be remiss if during wheat harvest we didn't talk about what things could go. I would think, building on what we had mentioned a few minutes ago, again, we're probably anticipating a seasonal low here for wheat, And no doubt that's the general, I guess, narrative of the market. But we heard Antonia Broyaka out of the AgEcon department, other people around the world talk about the great challenges of getting wheat out of Ukraine, and also that we have major drought in parts of Europe. That's also a major wheat supplier, that dry conditions in some in Russia. If you were to ask, to force Dan O'Brien to give his opinion, I think that the lows in the wheat market, as they stand on their own without the financial markets coming in, would be temporary. It seems we have enough strength and need for wheat around the world from a supply-demand point of view that prices we'd see now will be temporary through the harvest time. And again, that's assuming the overall economy numbers don't wash everything away. But overall, I would think that we'll have strength in the wheat market post-harvest, nothing that would indicate major weakness in it. And so we'll see.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I know you and I have talked before that your rhetoric, your language, making it clear to all of us and to the nation that we needed a balanced fiscal and monetary policy in response to the downturn created the political space for us to do what we did.
Speaking to the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, that's Sean Casten, a representative from Illinois.
I don't think we could have done that without your voice. And the fact that we had as not only as rapid a recovery, but as equitable a recovery as we did, was because we had that space. And I think history will show that we owe you more gratitude than we've given you. And I thank you for that. The fact that wages grew fastest for the bottom quintile did not happen but for that fiscal policy that complemented what you were doing. And yet we find ourselves today with people talking about fear of a recession. And I would submit to you that the fear of a recession is not because our economy is weak, but because our democracy is weak.
Also in the hearing for the House Financial Services Committee, Representative French Hill from Arkansas.
I want to talk a little bit about a rising interest rate environment and the impact on the Fed itself. The New York Fed released projections for the Fed's balance sheet as a part of its annual overview of its 2021 open market activities. And they announced to the public that the Fed portfolio could run a projected loss of about $300 billion through 2024 as interest rates continue to rise, since you have an enormous, the biggest in the world, I guess, a fixed income portfolio. The Fed's most recent financial statements for the first quarter show an unrealized capital loss of $450 billion during the quarter. So my first question is, does the Fed need a positive capital cushion in order to carry out its mission as our central bank?
No, we don't.
Can you explain to people why not?
Sure. So what we do is, our liabilities are, currency, for example, is a liability to us, and it doesn't earn, we don't pay any interest on it, but we own the contrary asset as Treasury bills, so we actually have substantial earnings, and we give those to the Treasury Department by law over the course of the year, and we've given $1 trillion worth of those earnings to the Treasury Department over the year. So we don't retain it as capital because we don't need it. It's literally not required for us to conduct the operations and do monetary policy. We don't, and we have a very thin sliver of capital. But it's sort of symbolic. It's just not something. We're not a private institution.
At the same time, on the other side of the Capitol, the Senate Ag Committee holding a hearing on livestock legislation. Senator John Thune from South Dakota.
It seems it's just insane to me that we don't have the very thing that we put in the center of our plate labeled when everything else that comes into this country has to be labeled. So, I know this is not, I've been asked by everybody not to offer this amendment today, but I'm just going to tell you, the issue is not going away. We got a farm bill coming up, and at some point, we're going to have to go on the record about whether or not we support labeling beef and pork. And again, in a way, this bill is designed in a way to give USTR and USDA a lot of input into how this is done, but I will simply tell you that when you're talking about transparency in markets, when you're talking about pricing, there probably isn't anything that is more important to that objective than giving consumers in this country an opportunity to be able to purchase products that are born, raised, and harvested right here in the United States, and giving producers in this country an opportunity to differentiate their product. When South Dakota livestock producers are proud of what they raise and grow, they are proud of the products that they produce, and they would love the opportunity to differentiate their product from other things around the world, just like every other product that comes into this country.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Friday's USDA cattle feedlot report provides more evidence that the cattle market is
tightening up.
Tightening up. USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum says that on June 1st, the nation's feedlots with 1,000 or more head capacity had an inventory of 11.8 million head, 1% more than June 1st of last year, the highest June 1st inventory since at least 1996. Shagum says, though, feedlot placements at 1.8 million head were 2% below May a year ago, and also among those placements, more lightweight cattle than normal.
It implies that conditions are still sufficiently poor in much of the country that you are being forced to put cattle into feedlots, probably a little bit earlier than expected. The fact that you don't have a whole lot of heavier weight cattle to be placed could be implying that we are looking at these tighter supplies of cattle.
We'll know more about that July 24th when USDA releases its cattle inventory report. Gary Crawford, Washington.